Herzlich willkommen zu Klassik Viral, dem Podcast gegen den Corona-Blues. Mein Name ist Arndt Kobbers und ich freue mich sehr über meinen heutigen Gast, den Weltklasse-Geiger Ning Feng. Er wohnt schon eine Weile in Berlin, sagt aber, sein Deutsch ist nicht gut genug für solch ein längeres Gespräch und deshalb führen wir das gleich auf Englisch. Und deshalb starte ich jetzt nochmal. Welcome to Klassik Viral, the podcast against the Corona Blues. My name is Arndt Kobbers and I'm very happy about my guest today, the world-class violinist Ning Feng. Great that it works out and that you are here and we can sit here in the garden in the
Absolutely,
sun.
Absolutely, yeah, it's my pleasure. For me, there.
Well, first of all, you told me that Feng is your first name and
yes.
Ning in the beginning is the family name.
Exactly.
But now, isn't it that normally Chinese names have three syllables?
Well, not in my generation. In my parents' generation, most of the people, like both my parents, they've got three syllables. So one syllable for the last name and two syllables for the first name. But in my generation, more than half of my, well, I don't have any siblings, but my cousins or my classmates, they've only got two syllables, so one for the family name, one for the first name.
All right.
But for my next generation, most of the kids actually have got two syllable first name, so in total three.
Okay.
So boom, 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 boom. Uh-huh. Things like this, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah. I'm sorry. I know it's creating a little confusion for for people from the West.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and also besides, in China it is like in Hungary, people put their first name last and last name first, like Bartok Bela. This is how would they do it. So this is also how we do it in China, and I somehow liked to keep that tradition or keep it in that way.
Yeah.
So
it
officially.
It was normal until, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years in Germany as well.
On the, oh,
on
really?
On the rural.
Okay.
So peasants or so. They had their family name and then the first name
okay.
at the last.
Okay.
That was a normal way to say one's name.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I didn't know about
that. Right. Yeah. Well, you're one of the, I would really say, you're one of the great virtuosos on the violin in the world, but you hide here somehow in Berlin as tutor at the Hochschule Hans Eisler. How comes? No one knows that you live here and you suddenly give concerts here.
I think everyone lives in Berlin now. How many, I mean, if we think about how many musicians who are based in Berlin, the number is incredible. I've got so many musician friends. I've even got so many professional musician neighbors. I remember that was about 10 months ago in June. So that was after the whole corona started, a few months after. Everyone was obviously staying home. But then we actually had a neighborhood concert. So we formed a string quartet with the people who actually live in the same building, all professionals, all professional musicians, and with one professional baritone singer. So we actually played a outdoor concert in June. That was late June, so it's very pleasant, the weather and sunny. So we played for the whole neighborhood, and there were, I think, like 200 people showed up. You know, we just put a small ad, small, you know, not even a poster, but just a piece of A4 paper, and just said, okay, we have a small concert, you know, very casual. If you like to show up, bring a chair, and we will be playing in the yard, which is outside of the building, you know, and a lot of people showed up, and we actually had fun. So, yeah, there are so many people living in Berlin, and I'm just among one of them. I mean, this is, I would say, one of the most culturally activated city and also friendly environment. So yeah.
And how is the contact or the communication between the musicians from all over the world in Berlin? I mean, you're colleagues, but you're your competitors as well for the concerts and that. Is this is a big family or is it both?
Well, I would say that's the nature of our human society. Everyone is in competition with somebody else. However, there's also friendship. I mean, of course, people have different personality, people have different musical educational background. So the people who have similar personality and similar cultural musical education background, then naturally it's easier for us to form a very closed group. And also, I mean, I know many people actually who are at my age, so, which is precisely about the age where you have small children. Mm-hmm. And that's a very big topic. So it's a very big area, common area in between all of us. Mm-hmm. So I would say, of course, it's competitive. It's like this everywhere else. But in the same time, I also enjoy that the relationship that we are close friends, but also in the same time, there are some kind of competitive thing or competitive feeling going on in between us. And that's the motivation as well for us to try to become the better version of ourselves in the future. Mm. So
let's have a look back into your history. Mm-hmm. Is the story true? I read that you, when you were 4 years old, you wanted to start violin, and the first teacher said you would never learn the violin properly because your pinky, your kleiner finger, was too small.
Yes, I mean, she didn't say that I wouldn't learn it properly, but she said I'm not the best type to learn the violin. So I was rejected, mm-hmm. which is actually true in some way. I mean, I don't think it's what she said was incorrect.
Mm-hmm. But your pinky now smaller than usual?
Well, my pinky is relatively mm-hmm. short in comparison with... Yeah.
Well, it's always short, isn't it?
It's yeah. But in terms of actually how much it is shorter mm-hmm. than the ring finger.
Yeah.
You see, the distance, mm-hmm. if we compare our hands, mm-hmm. yeah. And all the other three, the index, the middle uh-huh. finger, and the ring finger are yeah. like, you know...
Yeah, it's completely the last gleek.
The last one is almost like from a different person's hand.
Yeah.
So it's true. And also, it's really not straight.
Yeah,
I can't make it straight. It's always somehow a little twisted like this. Mm-hmm. And it's true that when it comes to violin, if one has a longer pinky, mm-hmm. which is the fourth finger on the violin, or on a string instrument, it is a... quite a big mm. advantage. Mm. So I still sometimes do feel like that if my pinky is perhaps, I don't know, like 3 millimeters longer than or four than what I've got now, mm-hmm. it would make some parts in the piece, in the violin piece, easier.
Mm-hmm. But you don't need a special technique that you turn the whole hand a bit more players.
You are actually, it's true, I need you to, but it's not a special, it's just a little more I have mm-hmm. to do than the other people. Mm-hmm. So I do have to turn, if I have to use the fourth finger, I do have to turn my hand a little more towards the left hand side.
All right.
To the left shoulder, uh-huh. to that side. Uh-huh. And also I probably have to sometimes to twist my wrist a little more to reach the higher notes. So it is not the best situation. I still remember that actually my dad took me to that place where it's actually what they call in China, it's called the Children's Palace, where you normally bring your kids during the weekend. Mm-hmm. And what they've got, you know, musical lessons, dancing lessons, also this, you know, traditional, we've got this brush pen mm-hmm. to write traditional mm-hmm. characters, all this kind of, you know, things that you don't normally learn at school. It's not like a required study at school. So they provide this kind of, you know, lessons, class in this children's palace. So my dad brought me there. And so I remember that all the students, all the kids were queuing in a line and one by one. I mean, it's true because we've got a huge number of population in China. So it's not like that there's enough space for everyone who wants to do. So they have to come up with some kind of system to select. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was unfortunately, well, actually back then I felt fortunate that I was rejected because I didn't want to practice the violin. I thought, okay, well, I don't have to practice. I can just play mm-hmm. after kindergarten. You know, I don't have to do some work. So I was actually quite happy I mean, I didn't feel anything. But then half year later, actually through my mom's working connection, because she's a doctor, anyone gets sick, so anyone goes to the hospital. So she, as a person who works in the hospital, who, I mean, she really meets everyone, you know, every professions in the society. And then through one of her colleagues, and they found out that there's another violinist from the local orchestra who started to open a small violin class. So, and then by then, when we got to know the news, actually the procedure was already finished 2-3 weeks ago. But then my father said, okay, let me still try. So we contact the teacher. I said, okay, would you still have one more place? And because it's actually how we started this quasi Suzuki method. So it's one teacher with a class of like 14, 15, or up to 20 students, small kids. So it didn't really matter so much. It was one extra in the big class. So I started with him.
All right. And is it true that it was not your wish or your dream to play the violin, but your father's dream?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I was four.
Yeah. And it's normally said that it's very bad if parents project their wishes to their children.
Yes and no. I would say that one, probably, if a four-year-old, five-year-old would voluntarily sit there for half an hour at beginning, half an hour, or later on, 1 hour or 2 hours, when it reach the age of, let's say, 10, to practice either the piano or violin. I wouldn't say there's completely no, but maybe one out of a million kids would do that. The majority of the young kid, they would probably have 5 minutes passion with one thing, and then they would do something else. And especially when it comes to master such a complicated instrument on the piano, on the violin, cello, especially actually on the violin, I would say, because the sound is ugly. On a kiddie size violin, the sound is not good. It's really nothing related with what we now think of, oh, a very lyrical singing voice of the violin. Nothing connected. It's ugly and almost, I would say, unbearable. It's just not nice. And for the kids to do such work for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or half an hour, it's inhuman. So one has to force a little bit. So yes, it's true, because my parents are from a generation where, unfortunately, everything was banned from the Western world, especially when they were teenagers, because the Cultural Revolution, everyone knows, both my parents were born in the 1950s. So the Cultural Revolution started precisely when they were a teenager, and it lasted for 10 years. And we all know how important that 10 years, you know, between your 15 to 25, how important, because that's when you really gather so much information and you develop your personality, your view of the whole world, whatever. And if you forbid people from that age to do something, once they see a small gap and they somehow explore it to that whole world, it somehow makes them more interesting. So the desire of them wanting to learn it or to get to know it, it's even more. So because, I mean, you can't really, although it's banned, but you really cannot ban everything. So with radio or some records or some secretly kept instruments, they were somehow introduced with the classical music, and of course they fall in love with it. I actually share the same background with 90% of my former classmates. I mean, musical from the conservatory. So none of us are coming from I would say 90% of us don't come from a musical family, but our parents, they love classical music. And unfortunately, they couldn't learn it. So they send their kids to learn this instrument. So in a way, I was forced. I was forced to practice. But there's one thing I think I still benefit is that although I was told, okay, now you have to do half an hour every day at the beginning, maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, a little by little increased. But I was never told that I have to, for instance, okay, be the best in the class, or I have to get the prize when I go to the competition, or I have to get into the conservatory. It was actually my choice when I was about to finish my primary school. I had the option of either going to the normal school, academic high school, or to the high school which is attached to the conservatory. And actually, I made the choice myself that I wanted to study music professionally when I was 11 years old. So before, I mean, I did competitions, I did some performances, but my father, although he said, oh, you have to practice. But when I'm actually doing something to present a result, he was never expecting any result from this. So, I mean, what he told me before when I was young, translated in English, is that, okay, you play the violin, I'm not asking you to play it well, but I'm asking you to not play it badly. Mm-hmm. So this is what he's saying. And this, I mean, this is still what I tell myself, because I know no matter how hard I try, there are always people who can do it better than I do. So I just do my best. Mm. Yeah.
Was that exotic in old times, 30 years ago, 35 years ago?
It's quite. It's. I mean, in terms of
when you were studying,
like violin or
violin.
Well, when I was young, it's not. It's not anymore because things was opened up already. Everything was allowed. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't call it exotic when I was young. The only problem is because the generation before, because it was completely forbidden, we had a gap of, I mean, in the education. So that's why when I was young, there was a kind of shortage of teachers. I mean, there's a conservatory, of course, but I mean, from the 60s until the 80s, nothing was really happening. So for 20 years there, it's not developed at all. Classic music is also only really introduced starting from 50, so we had 10 years of development and another 20 years.
Mm-hmm. But you grew up even listening to classical music.
Yes,
that was, for you.
Yeah. That was normal because I was born in the 80s already.
Yeah.
So back then, it's just it's everything's normal. It's everything's normal.
And then after school, you went to you studied in China then, and then you went to London.
I went to London to exactly. To study. Yeah.
Would you say that's a good idea to leave China then, or to come to Europe?
I would say I would say it's necessary. It's not only a good idea. It's also necessary because music is a language, and classic music is a language which was developed in Europe. You can learn the technical side of this language if you don't live in the place where the language was developed. But you don't learn the spirit, you don't learn the soul unless you move there. It's almost like an accent. I mean, different languages have different accents, even though, you know, people talk English differently in America, in Australia, in England. I mean, the same word, potato, potato, you have to understand where does it come from, in which area people speak in which way. So to learn this language, one needs to come to where it's from in order to feel, in order to be able to speak. Because I would say I'm playing the violin. If somebody heard my performance and then criticized, saying that, well, very good, but it's a very typical Asian way of interpreting this piece. And I would say, okay, this is, for me, something that I would feel very, very disappointed. I mean, not because of the critic, but disappointed in myself that I haven't been able to present the classical music in a way which is supposed to be present it.
But is there only one way to present this music? Only the Western or European way to present this music?
I would say there is definitely more than one way, but it needs to be from a foundation that is matching the whole picture, the idea, the atmosphere. For instance, that in the string instrument interpretation, there's a very commonly and wildly used technique. It's the slides, glissando. And in the Oriental music, there's also a lot of glissando that we use. But the way we use it, it's so different. There are many violin pieces, but there's one very famous Chinese violin concerto. It's called the Butterfly Lover Violin Concerto. And even actually many, it's getting more and more popular, even many Western. First of all the Chinese violinists play that piece. And now even some well-known Western violinists playing that, like Augustin Dume plays it a lot, and even Gil Shaham recorded it.
So
it's getting more and more popular. But in order to play that, we have to add so much glissando to make it fit into that style. But if we use as much glissando or exactly the same way as how we slide from one note to the other to play Brahms, I would say, I'm sorry, that's not right. It's a little bit in this way. I mean, I don't know whether this is totally correct, but imagine that the word in English, Name, and in German, it's the same, Name. If we look at it, it's the same, but if I'm actually speaking in English now, I said, well, my Name is, and that would be, probably you would still understand it. But if we put this in a play, a theater play, if the actor is speaking like this, then I don't think this is correct. So there are certain things that we could combine, but there are also certain things. Fundamentally, I think it needs to be one way than the other.
But if I think about jazz music, I mean, jazz music is very obviously American music, but it's now so common. It's part of our musical culture here. You wouldn't really say in Europe that's American music, and you don't have to go to America or to have a professor who is American to learn proper jazz music, because there's so many jazz musicians here. But yes. Maybe it's a different jazz music here in Europe than in America.
And also because I think jazz music, American people originally, they are Europeans.
That's true.
As well.
Or Africans.
Exactly.
Even more African than European, but it's both.
So there are, it's somehow related. There are some blood relationship. So I would definitely say, so it's perhaps a little more connected, but the Oriental, I mean, it's like when I'm traveling, sometimes I practice in the hotel room, and in order to not annoy my neighbors in the hotel room so much, I always put on a little TV sound. So people hear perhaps a little mixture, not just the violin. And there's a ad on the CNN news channel. It's about India. So they are putting some very nice pictures, you know, and it's called Incredible India. I mean, it's a very beautiful, ad for 30 seconds. But, I mean, I enjoy the photo so much. It's so nice. But then when I see that ad is coming up in between the news or in between different programs, I have to mute the TV. Why? Because at the very end, there's about 5 seconds, there's a voice singing in the melody Incredible India. But then, we have 12 tones, so semitones. So my ear are trained. Of course, there's harmonically, the sharps can be a little sharper. The leading notes, it could be a little sharper, going to the tonic note. But then in that voice, again, beautiful voice, but the intonation is as typical Middle Eastern tone, where it's actually in between the semitone. Mm-hmm. So it's somewhere like a quarter. It goes like da da da, indeed da, incredible indeed da, da da da. It's just in between that semitone, and I could not resist that pitch, because for what I have been educated or trained my ear, that is out of tune. Mm-hmm. And I've been taught ever since I started playing the violin to immediately correct that when something's like that happen. So for me, it's such a pain to hear the pitch, which is in the classical music standard, out of tune. Mm-hmm. But this is how it's supposed to be. If they actually played that in tune, it wouldn't be Indian music. So there's, I mean, this kind of, you know, similar way in between, I mean, fundamental difference in between the Western classic music, mm-hmm, and the Oriental music, yeah. Or even talking about jazz music. Jazz musicians, they don't play with music.
That's true.
They improvise. So,
but that means this classical Western music will always be Western music. So it's popular all over the world, but it will always be,
yes,
connected or centered in the West, in this,
yes,
culture.
I would say, I would say so. And mm-hmm, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. Because this is where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like Chinese food. There's everywhere Chinese food. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there are also very good, very nice Chinese, mm-hmm, restaurants outside of China.
Mm-hmm. And there are even some Chinese restaurants that are run by Turkish people.
Exactly,
or by
exactly.
Italian it can
can also be very nice. Yeah. But I would say that the Chinese food is still in China. Because this is where it's coming from. If someone who owns a Chinese restaurant, who is a chef of a very nice, good Chinese restaurant, but if the chef never actually have been to China, I would say that's also a pity. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you have the privilege that you have been doing for 10 years or more CDs, a lot mm-hmm of CDs for mm-hmm Channel Records, which is quite a good record company, from Holland. But there's dominating, if you look at the repertoire, there's dominating, I have a feeling, the virtuoso music. You did mm-hmm a lot of Paganini and Vuitton and Ravel's Zigane and Lalo and whatever, and now the mm-hmm the new CD is the 24 Caprice by mm-hmm Paganini. Is this your favorite repertoire? It's just the repertoire that the CD market wants from you.
Well,
and normally you play the big repertoire, the sonatas and...
Yes and no. Well, I mean, my latest CD is the 24 Caprices, but unfortunately, because two other recording projects that was planned last year canceled. We wanted to bring up one of the concerto recordings, which was Brahms Concerto and Goldmark Concerto, with the Concerthaus Orchestra, which was supposed to happen in March last year. But in March, so everything started to stop mm-hmm then. So it was unfortunately canceled. And in April, I was going to record the Beethoven Concerto and the Romance in a live concert with the City of Birmingham Orchestra. Again, didn't happen. At the end, this was the only thing ready. We were going to release this after mm-hmm the two concerto recordings. But unfortunately, these two were canceled. So, as I said earlier, I mean, luckily I mean, this recording could still take place because it was happening in January mm-hmm 2020. So it was before everything's starting to fall into parts, and it's just one person, it's for solo. So this is not something from that point of view, something intentional or deliberate, because it had to be like this. But on the other hand, it's true, because I just turned 40 a few days ago.
Oh, well, so, congratulations.
I feel like the desire of me, of myself, doing this kind of stuff is getting less and less. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I spent quite a lot of time when I was younger trying to dig in on the technical side of the instrument, because this is my profession. I play the violin. I wanted to be able to know the instrument as much as I can. I mean, on a technical, I mean, mm-hmm, purely violinistic way. So I spent quite a lot of time, and I wanted to have a record showing that I used to be able to do this. But in the same time, I know, I mean, it's like, you know, to be a part of the society, to survive in the society, we need money. Everyone is working for money. We need money to survive. But once we have the money, we should learn how to let the money to serve us and to serve the society. We don't serve the money. We don't work for money. It's the same thing. I spent a lot of time when I was much younger learning the technique, but I know that technique is to serve the purpose of music. But if I have the technique, why should I hide it? Mm-hmm. If I do have, I mean, this is a dream now for all the violinists in my generation or younger, but if I do have enough money, why wouldn't I spend the money to buy a Stradivarius? Mm-hmm. Or the Jews, why would I have to hide that, the fact that I could afford it? If, I mean, it's just hypothetical, if I'm afraid, of course I don't. But if I do, why would I have to hide, okay, I don't have it? So of course I would go for it. It's the same thing with why I'm doing a lot of, you know, I used to play, and I now recorded the 24 Caprices, is that, okay, if I mean, I'm able to do it, then why not? Mm-hmm. I show the world, and actually also to show myself when I'm much older, that you see, I was still, when I was younger, mm-hmm. although I don't do it now, maybe I'm, my fingers are not as fast as before, or I just simply don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. I used to be able to do it. So then this is the proof. Mm-hmm. And then there's also another reason. Paganini is definitely not my favorite composer. Definitely not. But because it's so technically difficult, and his music is also being somehow unfairly criticized, or actually I would say the performance, mm-hmm. people what we hear, mm-hmm. Somehow unfairly criticized that it's not music.
Mm-hmm. Like circus or like
exactly.
artistry.
Well, it's not deep music for mm-hmm. sure, but it's still pleasant. Mm-hmm. It's something that you know, after you listen, it should still have a very nice, sweet smile in your mm-hmm. face, because mm-hmm. it's nice. Mm-hmm. It makes you happy. You know, and this is precisely what I wanted to bring or to show to the rest of the world mm-hmm. through my fingers, that it's difficult, but if someone listens to how I play the piece, I actually don't want them to feel the piece is difficult. But it's nice romance, a nice comedy that people feel so warm. It might not touch your soul, mm-hmm. like you listen to Beethoven, late quartet, or Bach. Definitely not. It wouldn't do that. But it makes you feel warm and happy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, small dessert. You know, we never eat that for main dish. But they're so pretty and sweet. I would say, why not?
Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. One question back to the technique. How is this feeling if you have the feeling you can play everything you want and there's no limit, no technical limit anymore? Or well, when you found out and you're studying violin, well, now I'm at the point I can play everything. What's written anyhow? Well, must be a great feeling.
Well, I have to say that I have a lot of records. And I'm actually, music is also my hobby. I really enjoy listening to music. And I collect a lot of recordings. And it's really unfair for the string players. I mean, especially I listen to recordings from an old masters, how they used to play, for instance, as a violinist, how they used to play when they are 20, 30, 40. Most people, when they reached the age 60, you hear immediately the difference, purely technically. Although musically, sometimes they still might give you some, you know, incredible inspiration. But technically, you hear it's going down. On the piano, you don't hear it. Because if someone's playing Mozart at the age of 70 or 80, because it's not so musically, not so technically demanding like Liszt or Rachmaninoff. So purely it's music, and a person who has 60 or 70 years of experience of music making, and you can show everything to your audience. But for 70 or 80 year old playing on the violin, because on the violin, you have to control not only the beginning of the violin, of the sound, you have to control until the very end of it. The vibrato, the bow, stability of the bow, and everything. You really hear the descent of the technical ability. I know I might be able to play almost everything now, but it's not going to last forever. This is also the fact that I know. So this is precisely also the reason I recorded. So, and this is really the last solo virtuoso stuff I'm going to record. Yeah.
No, Isaiah.
I mean, it's not purely technical.
That's true, but it's very, very difficult to play, isn't it?
It's very well written. Isaiah is very difficult, but because he was... Mm-hmm. I tell you the fact that, for me, the most difficult, technically, violin pieces are not Paganini, or Isaiah, or Ernst. Well, they are difficult, but they were written by violinists. So they know what's reasonable difficulty. There are two other composers who have written quite a lot of violin music, great composers, but not only musically difficult, but technically almost unbearable, Schubert and Bartok. These two composers, the Schubert Fantasy in C major for violin and piano, for piano and violin, it's perhaps one of the most, not only musically, but also technically difficult piece for the violin. It's incredibly uncomfortable. And in the same time, you have to make it all the difficulties on the technical side not audible. You cannot show it. It has to, all these high notes, which is so pianistic, has to come so elegantly. And with this typical, Schubert, Austrian, lightness, many, many places. So that's incredibly complicated and difficult to achieve. And the other one is Bartok. Both, I mean, the two of his most famous violin pieces, the solo sonata and the second violin concerto, to play it, it's almost impossible.
Really?
So that's why there's, for the solo sonata, when it was freshly written, it was commissioned by Yehudi Menuhin. Actually, before, there was a Yehudi Menuhin edition where actually he modified a bit of the original piece in order to be able to play it on the violin. There are technical things that we theoretically can make it happen on the instrument, but in reality, realistically, actually impossible to play on the violin. So these are actually the most two difficult composers that I would say, because I mean, maybe on the other hand, of course, all these Paganini technical ideas, because we practiced from a very earlier age, so it might actually seem less uncomfortable because you are used to it already, so you don't feel uncomfortable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Bartok and Schubert techniques, they are uncomfortable, difficult, and you are not used to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Is that something you like, especially playing solo? You did quite a lot of solo CDs. You did the Prokofiev and Hindemith.
Not necessarily, but that was actually because the solo repertoire, it's really just a very, very small part of the violin repertoire. So, as you actually said, Izai is actually in my plan to record next. Because then I would say that I would have most of the important solo piece written for violin all recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, this is one thing accomplished for me. Because as a musician, I always think that all the musicians, how can they be remembered by the history? I think the answer is composition. I mean, all the great composers now, we call them composers, but they were performers as well, musicians. Mm-hmm. You know, they, it's just back then they mostly performed their own piece. I mean, not mostly, but they often performed their own piece. But let's say 150 years ago, composer and performer, they become two different profession, almost like that. The composer mainly focusing on composing. Performer performs. In the violin history, the last two were Kreisler and Ionescu. And after that, it was Joshua Heifetz, who only arranged, never really composed. And nobody really could call themselves a composer. Well, actually, even Kreisler, on a composer level, he only write violin music, although very popular. But I would say Ionescu was perhaps considered as a composer because he also composed not only violin but also piano and orchestral works. And on the piano, I would say probably Rachmaninoff. So now people who performs mostly only focusing on performing, and I know I have no talent in composition at all. So I'm sometimes thinking, how can I be remembered, or how would I be able to leave a very, very small mark in the musical history? Because it's something I love, it's something I've been doing, something I will be doing for the rest of my life. And I think the answer is recording. Mm-hmm. And precisely as I described earlier, that for sonatas, for other concertos, I think I still have, I would say maybe 15, 20 years, the ability to do it. But the solo stuff where it's much more demanding, especially, you know, these technical things, mm-hmm. I would say, okay, I do it now and that's it. Mm-hmm. Although, of course, there are Bach. I would say that towards the end of my career, performing career, before I know that I'm not able to do it properly, I would like to record it one more time. Mm-hmm. So probably in 15, 20 years, I don't know. So when I'm about 60, so I can still physically do it. So I can still, there are two marked prestos in all the six sonatas and partitas from Bach. I mean, when I can still play a presto tempo on the violin, I'll make another recording of Bach, because I did the Bach recording when I was 35. And that's the age where somehow my life is kind of stabilized in many ways, from many aspects, like my family. I'm married, I've got kids, I've got my career established, so I know I can live as a freelancing soloist for the rest of my life. So it's the starting point of my, I wouldn't call it my life, but starting point of a very important era of my life. So I decided to record the Bach at that point, besides I've already had many years of performing, practicing the piece, you know, starting from when I was a student and also going to the competitions and playing concerts. So that's already like I would say more than 10 years of experience. So which means that technically it's there. And I kind of started to understand what life is about. And by the end of this era, or close to the end of the era, so I have really experienced most of what life is about, I like to do it again. And actually many violinists did this. There are two pieces in, well actually two sets of pieces, that I feel like that there's never a end of understanding the depth of it. One is Beethoven Violin Concerto. No matter how many times, actually I feel so incredibly fortunate that Beethoven Concerto is actually, I would say, the most frequently played concerto, I mean, for me, for myself. But every time, regardless of which orchestra, with which conductor I played it, I feel so emotionally touched. And then the other one is Bach, especially the Chaconne. There's also one funny fact is that I teach, and from time to time I have students playing Chaconne for me. And I would sometimes demonstrate one spot when I'm trying to make some suggestions. But when this only happens when I'm teaching Chaconne, is that when I started demonstrating, I have to force myself to stop playing. Because the music drives me continually performing, playing the piece. Somehow, I really have to tell myself, okay, now it's a lesson, it's not performance. So maybe after 30 seconds, I've been already been playing like, I mean, I was talking about this one particular bar, but I was already gone to like 10 bars later. I said, okay, no, stop. I had to tell myself to stop. The music really drives me. So these two pieces, if I get the chance, if I have the luxury to do it, definitely I would try to record at least twice, and earlier and later, especially Bach. So this is, I mean, what we've been talking about. So, I mean, as a violin performer, as a violinist, it's almost like the first chapter and the last chapter of the novel. Or imagine we are listening to the Goldberg variation, how we start the piece, and after 30 variations, how we end the piece, and the feeling. So maybe it's a little too early to think about that, but this is my goal. So in a way, the recording is partially my plan to leave my small, teeny mark in the history.
I understand, yeah. Some nearly 10 years ago, you founded with three colleagues the Dragon Quartet, a string quartet. Let's say 20, 30 years ago, it was something for specialists. But now more and more quartet players dare to play quartet.
Yeah.
Is this sort of a high-level hobby for you, or is that, do you really do it with ambition?
Well, I think it's a hobby because I think for nowadays, the ultimate goal or the ultimate challenge as a string player is not Paganini. It's not these technical things. Definitely not. It's string quartet. Definitely. Beethoven, Mamma Mia. Incredible. The late quartets. It's so much in advance that now, 200 years later, it's still ahead of us. And to be able to make the string quartet work, it's such a challenge. I mean, first of all, the four people have to be the master of their own instrument, and they have to share the same musical idea, the same musical understanding. And they have to have the same goal. And most importantly, they have to have enough time. So the reason why I formed the quartet with my colleagues is because we all love chamber music so much. And the funny fact, not funny, so the I would say the harsh fact is that if I'm invited or if I'm playing in a chamber music festival, I can be playing in any kind of ensembles except string quartets. I can be playing string trio, string quintet, string sextet, octet, or piano trio, piano quartet, piano quintet, etc. But I would say 95% of the time, if a chamber music festival needs certain string quartet pieces to be performed, they would invite a professional group, string quartet, to play it. So I never had the opportunity to play string quartets except with my own quartet.
But of your colleagues, I mean, you live in Berlin, one is in
exactly.
München, one is in Beijing. I don't know where the fourth lives, but
in Singapore.
Singapore.
So we gather 3 weeks, 2 weeks, and then a very intensive rehearsal for almost 1 week, and then concerts and recordings. Yeah, unfortunately, the older we get, unfortunately, yeah, that's true. I mean, I feel really funny because we haven't been playing for a while now. I mean, partially because of the corona, it's getting so difficult to travel. Mm-hmm. And also because that the older we are, the more things we have to do. I mean, we all have our own individual professions. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all musicians, but like we have two orchestra musicians and two other soloists. And we all live in different parts. The orchestra musicians, they've got to figure out with the season schedule with the own orchestra and to come up with, yeah. So it's very fortunate, but we still are planning to get back together once the situation allows us to do so. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was just talking to the other violinist from our quartet 2-3 weeks ago because I found one of our video recordings as I was going through my stuff, and I put it on the computer. I was watching it. Actually, it was that was the Debussy quartet we were playing, and I was really touched, and not because that I thought we played so wonderfully well, but I was touched by the music itself in the second movement. It's a little melancholic, but beautiful, beautiful, beautiful music that it just makes you want to cry. And I also miss that the time that we spent together, even we were arguing, you know, about, you know, how to phrase one line or something, or we are spending, you know, half an hour like a student, like we were students, just on getting the intonation, you know, perfectly in tune. And that was a wonderful time. Of course, it's also because of the corona that people don't play now. And what I said is that I miss the most is that being able to serve the society. Mm-hmm. What I'm supposed to do, what my duty is. Because my duty is to... We said, what's music? Music is what the composer had written down. There are notes, you know. But if you bring that book to the people who don't actually know how to read this, it doesn't mean anything. It's a white paper with black notes, mm-hmm. and that's it. Mm-hmm. So, and we are the interpreters. We learned the language, and we learned how to use our hand and the instrument, which is the tool, to bring that black note alive to the people who appreciate them. And now, I mean, I didn't have that opportunity anymore. I mean, of course, I mean, this is my job. This is how I support my living. This is, mm-hmm. You know, there's a technical side as well in our life, which is, what as I said, you know, there's the financial side as well. But I really think my mission in my life is to bring that joy of music. But now I don't have the platform to deliver my job. And this is really heartbreaking. Of course, everyone's doing, you know, online things now. I also have done quite a lot of online work. But online work is like canned food or instant noodle, instant food. Do we need them? Yes, we do. And we will always need them. But if we have the choice of fresh food, of course, we go for the freshly made food.
True.
And if people only take canned food, preserved food, for a long time, it's bad for the health, for sure. The internet provides a great opportunity, which actually somehow, I'm so grateful, actually, which partially kept the profession alive, I have to say. Because with the teaching, I've got students now living in New Zealand, in Norway. I can still teach them mm-hmm. through the internet. Mm-hmm. But it's not the same. We cannot do this. We cannot only, you know, sit in front of the computer. It's exactly like what we're doing now. We could have done this over the internet, mm-hmm. over the phone. Mm-hmm. But it's never the same mm-hmm. when you actually see the people and feel. I often tell my students who is about to make a recording, either for the competition or actually a proper recording, I said, okay, the biggest challenge is to imagine yourself when you are making the recording, you have to imagine yourself, you're actually playing for a live audience. There is actually one small fact. All my live recordings are faster than my studio recordings. This Paganini recording, it's almost 80 minutes, so it's actually almost the full length of the CD. There's a video that I played in front of audience. It's 8 minutes shorter than the CD.
That's quite a difference.
Yeah. It's a big difference. So if there are people in the concert hall, 300, normally, you know, it's chamber music hall, 300, or a big symphonic concert hall, 1,500, let's say. If there are people there and they don't make any sound, they are silent. And in comparison with an empty hall, which is also completely silent, but we feel the difference, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference. There's some chemistry in the atmosphere, definitely. Mm-hmm. And that gives the performer extra energy. Well, honestly, it makes the performer nervous. Mm-hmm. But how to overcome from that stage fright? You know, whether you completely, you know, lose control and have memory collapse, you know, and just completely screwed up the performance, or actually drives you to go 120% of what you normally can do. And that's the fundamental difference. Mm-hmm. So in the recording, I always try to, I'm getting better and better, but still the live recordings I play, it's very, very, very different than a studio. I'm trying to represent that in a studio recording session. I'm getting closer, but it's never as good as what happened in the concert hall. And I don't think it will ever be as good because that's the nature. So the live concert is, I miss that. I miss the stage. I definitely miss. And this is, hopefully, yeah, the situation will change.
Yeah.
Yeah, end of the year or whatever. Yeah.
Let me ask one last point.
Sorry, I talk too much. Yeah.
No, that's very interesting. Why do you teach? I mean, you could be busy traveling around and
thank you for
concerts.
Asking. Thank you for asking. This is something that I find so incredibly helpful to myself. Mm-hmm. Let me put it this way. To teach, I mean, if we explain what teach means, it's to tell the other people what is not good enough. And in order to do so, one has to know why that's not good enough, for what reason, technically or musically. And second of all, you have to provide a solution, a better solution, what to do to make it better and why. So this involves a lot of analyzing. And if I do it myself, I don't have to convince myself. I can just say, I feel like doing this. You know, I feel like having a tea now, or I feel like having a coffee now. I don't have to say, okay, this is why. But if I have to make other people convincingly follow my instruction, I have to explain to them, this is why, with a very, very concrete and strong reason. And the process actually really helps me understanding why I'm not doing this. And this really helped me, first of all, either knowing or feeling even more confident of what I used to do. I said, yes, this is, it's quite correct and I know why. Or actually say, okay, well, that was actually not so smart. It was actually stupid to do this because I couldn't know. I couldn't come up with a strong reason to suggest it. So I should maybe do it some other way. So this is, I find extremely, extremely, extremely helpful, you know, not just telling other people, but also with my own way of either understanding the piece technically or musically. So it's been helping me tremendously to try to tell myself why I should be doing this, or force myself to analyze what I do. So, I mean, we all have instinct, but instinct Might be right, might be wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. We could go on end. It's very interesting. But we've been talking for quite a while now. So I would say a very last question. If the Corona blues comes to you and the tristesse, and you say, well, is there any music, anything that makes you happy, gives you joy and gives you hope for the future? Any special music?
Well, I would say Mozart.
Mozart?
Mozart. Mozart, because Mozart's music are always... He really, you rarely use minor. I mean, there are minor pieces, but majority are in major. That's the hope. That's really the hope of Mozart's music. I mean, one thing I think what's so incredible about Mozart is, I mean, of course, Beethoven, Brahms, Bach are also, you know, are great composers, but I can, well, I mean, I would say most of the pieces written by Bach, Beethoven, or Brahms cannot be listened as a background music. I mean, I really have to sit down and clean my mind and appreciate the piece, you know, have a quiet place. But Mozart, it works every way, you know. If you have, you know, kids running around, if you have the Kleinnacht music, it's fantastic.
True.
But if you are by yourself, 10 o'clock in the evening, you play any piece of Mozart, it also gives you as deep feeling, you know, inspirational impact as well. So it really works every other way. Well, Vivaldi can also be, but, well, Four Seasons, nice, very nice, but I wouldn't necessarily, you know, turn down the lights and try to enjoy the Four Seasons, you know, all by myself. I mean, no offense, but it's nice music, but it doesn't really require that setting for people to really appreciate, but Mozart really. So, and it's, I would say, yeah, it's the sunlight, it's the hope, yeah, and I hope that the hope will come soon.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ning Feng, for this talk. Und vielen Dank fürs Zuhören.
Ja, vielen, vielen Dank.